Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform. Welcome to you on behalf of Senator Rockefeller and our board of directors to this program about what we used to call long-term care and now call long-term services and supports. That is the range of supportive services for those who need help with normal activities of living as a result of some disability or condition. And we care about long-term services and supports because 11 million Americans need these services and because collectively we spend more than $200 billion a year on them and because Medicaid finances more than half of that total at a time when state and federal governments are facing some pretty stiff fiscal challenges, we have another level of interest in this bundle of programs. Now, we know that home and community-based care, besides being far preferred by those needing the care over services delivered in a nursing home, has the potential to restrain spending over the kinds of projections that we've been seeing. So for several years, many states have been moving to rebalance their Medicaid spending on long-term services and supports away from institutional care toward home and community-based services. The new health reform law, in addition, offers some tools that are designed to help states speed that transition. So today, we're going to look at some examples of rebalancing in the real world and at how well these policy initiatives are working that are aimed at encouraging that trend. Our partner and co-sponsor in this briefing, the Commonwealth Fund, is a philanthropy that's been serving the common weal or common good for the better part of a century, and we're pleased to have as a co-moderator today Dr. Mary Jane Corrin. You ought to read her bio. I'm not going to take the time to give her the introduction that she deserves, but she's a geriatrician, easy for me to say, a vice president of the Commonwealth Fund, and it's always comforting, Mary Jane, to have someone next to you who really, really understands the subject. Why don't I yield to you at this point, and maybe you can set us up and tell us why we're here in a more compelling way.
Good afternoon, and thank you all for coming. I'm really impressed at how many people are here. Since very often long-term services and supports are kind of a sidebar issue for many people, focused as they are rather critically on just the acute care side of the equation. Do you have a little slide?
I do. I'm sorry.
This is just a very brief setting of the stage or the context to just give you some information so that you can then appreciate some of what the discussion will be today with some of our panelists. As you know, long-term services and supports is the term that we're starting to use to move away from the idea of long-term care because, in a sense, what we're really looking at is a system to enhance and to support independence rather than a smothering system to care for people. We also want to emphasize the fact that it's not just services, but it's also things like vital equipment that people get, and also sometimes home modification. If someone has a ramp in their home, often that's the difference between being homebound and being able to access the community and other services out in the community. So it is not just care for people, but it's also the supply of equipment, wheelchairs, walkers, other equipment like that, and also environmental modifications. Also, we had a lot of discussion when we were working on the long-term supports and services scorecard about really what the definition was, and we took as our definition services that extend beyond a period of 90 days, even though for post-acute care, many of the same providers are giving those services. We arbitrarily said, really, the things we're focusing on for the purposes of the scorecard and for today's discussion are for the people who really require these kinds of things for an extended period of time. as Ed mentioned, these are services that are primarily used by elderly people with physical impairments or disabilities, cognitive impairments, as well as younger people with disabilities. And one of the things that I think people really haven't focused on is that you can need long-term care almost at any moment. You can walk out of here, be hit by a car, have an early stroke, something like that, and you need long-term care. So it's not something that just starts when you're 65. This is a kind of system that people of all ages have to access. Obviously, it can be given in a person's home, out in the community, such as daycare services, congregate meal programs, or in residential settings. And the residential settings is one of the reasons we've kind of moved away from the idea of long-term care, because this is not just about nursing homes. When we tried to think about the scorecard, we really tried to think about what the framework for a high-performing system would be. And what's interesting about this slide are two things. First of all, the domains that the advisory groups that we were working with, which included a wide range of stakeholders, agreed to were very different domains for high performance than you would typically see, let's say, in a hospital system or even a clinic system. We're looking at things like having choice, supporting caregivers, thinking about quality of life. And these are areas that are not typically seen as areas for high performance in the rest of the system that we deal with. The other thing that's very interesting about this is that we really recognize that to think about quality for this system, it's how people move in the system. And so the idea of transitioning from one service or one level to another and having care coordinated. The interesting thing is, we couldn't find any data or any indicators to be able to measure that construct. And that's really important, given all the focus we're having today on rehospitalizations and so forth. These were the top findings, that huge variability, and even in the lowest performing states, there are things they're doing well. And even in the highest performing states, there are things they can do better. We also found that there's a clustering for poverty and high rates of disability, huge challenges for this system, and that the highest ranking states actually do have policies that kind of predispose them to their high performance. The long-term services and supports costs was the other thing that really stood out. Even for people of middle income means, they cannot afford these services over the long term. And I think that's something that is a message that we really need to get out to the public. This is just briefly what the scorecard looks like, ranks all the states. You're not supposed to be able to read it from there. But I will just tell you that Minnesota is at the top, Mississippi is at the bottom. But as I said, each state has areas that still need to be performing better. Even those that are doing a less good job really have areas that they are outstanding. And if you want to kind of look at it geographically, as you can see, the clustering down in the southeast area, kind of extending up into the Midwest areas, high rates of disability, high rates of poverty. So the scorecard is kind of a way to really take a snapshot picture of the United States and see what long-term services and supports looks like. Okay, long-term care and long-term services and supports is not just a state issue. There are lots of things that at a federal level can be done. As I said, that really we have no common definitions. We would have loved to put something in there on assisted living. There are 50 definitions of assisted living. So if we can get at a federal level to start to come up with commonly used definitions, creating these measures, and also trying to strengthen the data collection. As Ed said, we spend a tremendous amount of public money on these services, and to not be able to see the value you're getting for them is really to do a disservice to all the taxpayers who are putting the money in there. And lastly, certainly there are ways that we can put mechanisms in place to incentivize states to try to increase and to improve their long-term supports and services, and some of the things that we're working on, such as shared savings programs. So I'm going to stop there and turn the program over now to Cynthia.
Actually, I think we're going to start with Bob, and let me do a little logistics. Okay. You can pass that down to him if you want. You've got a lot of background information in your packets. That will all be online at allhealth.org, along with the slides that the speakers are going to be using. There will be a webcast of this briefing available sometime tomorrow through the support of the Kaiser Family Foundation on their website, kff.org. And there will be a transcript of the briefing available in a few days on our website. There's a podcast that you can have. Our friends at the Commonwealth Fund have a very interesting blog attached to their website that will have a post about this briefing presently, within the next day or two, and that's at commonwealthfund.org. Is that right? Okay. You've got green question cards for use at the appropriate time. You've got a blue evaluation form. We'd love for you to fill that evaluation form out, and as I said a couple of times ago, I need a new writer here. It's part of our pay-for-performance program. If we get half of you filling this out, we have a $100 check headed toward Whitman Walker. On the back of the evaluation form, in fact, there is a reminder of that. So look at the one side, fill out the other, and do well and do good at the same time. Now, enough delay getting to our panelists. We have a terrific group today. Brief presentations from each, then Q&A. And I just want to apologize for the room being approximately the temperature outside. We've asked them to try to do something about that. We have moderately high hopes that that can happen. We're not very successful making those kind of adjustments. We are grateful for you being here, not just because it's a subject that sometimes doesn't get the attention it deserves, but because here we are, it's the first Monday in October, and you're not watching the Supreme Court arguments. So we're pleased to have you with us. In the interest of brevity, let me introduce all of our panelists now. I commend to you the biographical sketches in the materials that do them a little more justice than I can do in this time. We're going to start off with Bob Horniak, despite what the written agenda says. Bob's the acting director of the Center for Policy Planning and Evaluation at the U.S. Administration on Aging within HHS. And before that, he headed AOA's Office of Home and Community-Based Services, appropriately enough, and he ran long-term services and sports programs in Indiana for the state government there. We'll follow Bob with Cynthia Woodcock, who until a few days ago was Director of Long-Term Services and Supports Policy and Research at the Hilltop Institute, which is a nationally recognized research center based at University of Maryland, Baltimore County, doing analysis and research aimed at improving the health and well-being of vulnerable populations. Now she's handling similar kinds of duties at Impact International, a social sciences research firm based in Columbia. And finally, Carol Raphael, part of our just-in-time inventory of speakers, who is the president and CEO of the Visiting Nurse Service of New York, the largest nonprofit home health agency in the United States. She's nationally recognized for her expertise in care quality in HIT. She served on MedPAC. We're really pleased to have her and our other speakers with us today. And Bob, I ask you to start off.
Well, thank you, Ed, and good afternoon to everyone. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here. Really want to thank the Alliance for Health Reform and the Commonwealth Fund for... not on?
No, it was on, but not working. Nope, I maybe just have to lean in a little.
Better? Ah, thank you. Again, thank you all for having me here today, and want to express my appreciation to the Alliance for Health Reform and the Commonwealth Fund for inviting me to represent the Administration on Aging today at this forum. I want to tell you a little bit about the presentation before I begin. I want to talk about accessibility to long-term services and supports, talk about some issues around caregiving, as well as care transitions and a number of other aspects that the Administration on Aging is engaged in. And certainly we don't do this on our own. Our principal legislation is the Older Americans Act. The Older Americans Act was passed in 1965, the same year as Medicaid and Medicare. Our budget of about $1.4 billion did not quite keep growth at the same rate that Medicaid and Medicare did. But we do a lot with that information, those dollars, and I want to share some of that information with you. First, when we talk about our aging network, I want to talk some about the infrastructure through which we deliver these services. The Older Americans Act, the Aging Network, reaches about 11 million people in this country every year. That's about one in five older adults across this country, age 60 and above. About 3 million of those individuals receive intensive services. By intensive services, we mean things like home-delivered meals, personal care, homemaker chore services. The Administration on Aging works with 56 state units on aging, 629 area agencies on aging, and 246 tribal organizations. Those entities then work with about 20,000 service providers across the country and hundreds of thousands of volunteers. And without those volunteers, the services such as home-delivered meals, transportation, other critical services really would not be able to be delivered. We really count on that cadre of volunteers across this country and greatly appreciate their work. The work that they do, this whole aging network, on the slide we have some of the 240 million meals that are delivered on an annual basis, 28 million rides to physicians, pharmacies, adult day services, and other important functions for older adults. But millions of hours of personal care, caregiver training, and about over 800,000 caregivers receive assistance through this. And we all know that 75% to 80% of all long-term services and supports in this country are provided by family, friends, neighbors, churches. That is what supports our long-term services in this country. And what we try to do with these service dollars that we receive is to really enable those caregivers and formal providers to continue to provide those services. But we also offer respite care to those caregivers because we know, especially for caregivers dealing with individuals who have Alzheimer's disease or related dementias, that 24-hour, 7-day-a-week, 365-day-a-year job of providing services to their loved ones is incredibly stressful. It can be very tiring, and that idea of taking a respite break is just crucial to them being able to provide services longer. So who do we serve through this aging network? Well, when we look at there are about 57.8 million older adults age 60 and above in this country, that we touch the lives of about 11 million of those, as I said. We know that about just over 9% of those older adults are at or below poverty. When we look at our statistics, about 30% of those individuals who receive services through the Older Americans Act are at or below poverty. But also somewhere between 75 and 85%, depending on which service, of our recipients are near poor. Near poor meaning that they are 150% of poverty or below. I'm going to talk mostly about our in-home and community-based services. We certainly have other provisions within the Older Americans Act for programs for Native Americans, our Title VI program, as well as protection of vulnerable elders, our ombudsman program, prevention of elder abuse and exploitation, and our legal services. But since we're really focusing on long-term services and supports in this outing, I'm going to focus most of my remarks around those. The strengths of this aging network, it's a large infrastructure. As I said, 629 area agencies that really reach across this country to older adults, but also to many persons with disabilities. We have a comprehensive person-oriented services that is very person-centric, focusing on the needs of that older adult and or person with disability. It's a trusted resource. Through our Aging and Disability Resource Centers, we really want to have a trusted resource in the community that older adults or persons with disability can contact for trusted information, a reliable source, as a one-stop shop, no wrong door, single point of entry. But we also have and are gaining great expertise in evidence-based programs that I'll talk about in just a minute. We really look at our systems integration and partnership as being key to success in delivering long-term services and supports. First is just access to long-term services and supports. As we think about any of our loved ones who need those types of services in the community, as we think about how do we begin to navigate that system, it is complex and in far too many places still fragmented. What we've tried to do through Aging and Disability Resource Centers, these no wrong door approaches, is to have a single point of entry for this access. Who do you call? How do you begin to navigate this system? Because without access, there is no quality. If you can't even get into the system, or it takes 50 calls to get into the system, it is much more difficult to say there is a quality program. A few of these programs just want to touch on are evidence-based programs through randomized controlled trials, publications in peer-reviewed journals shown efficacy. We know that these programs, such as Matter of Balance, to help prevent falls, caregiver programs such as REACH2 that have been tried and have been very effective in supporting caregivers of individuals with Alzheimer's disease or dementia, really make a difference in those caregivers' lives. Other evidence-based programs in terms of care transitions. We know that about 25% of Medicare recipients who are discharged from hospitals will be readmitted within 1 month. At 90 days, about 33% will be readmitted. Through carefully arranged care transition programs that support that individual from the hospital or nursing facility into the community, those individuals can remain home and can have a great offset to those Medicare claims. We're also working with our colleagues at the Department of Veterans Affairs. We are offering a veterans-directed home and community-based service program, really based, again, on randomized controlled trials of a program called Cash and Counseling, where veterans of all ages have control of their own budget. They hire who they want. They fire who they want. They coordinate the services in the way that makes best sense for them. One of the veterans that we've talked to in terms of respite care has said in previous programs what he was offered was for his wife's respite. He was offered either to go to the kennel or under house arrest. That is, he could go to a nursing facility or they would send in a home health aide, but the aide was not allowed to leave the home. Hence, he was not allowed to leave the home. That is not much of an aid to someone who still has some ability to get out of the home and enjoy his community supports. But we also look at our Alzheimer's and Caregiver Support Program that offers dementia-capable care and services to individuals and their families who are suffering from Alzheimer's disease. We do this in a person-centric way. That is, the person is the center of these things. It is not the services being arranged or this is what's available to you. How do we really begin to focus on the needs of the individual, how they want their services arranged, and in the right time, in the right manner for that individual? So where do we begin to go with this? This Venn diagram, I think, is the beginning of how we want to think about things, our aging and disability services being one of those circles. But public health. We have worked to a great degree with our friends at the CDC, at HRSA, at other CMS. How do we begin to look at the intersection between our aging programs and public health? We begin to think of that as where our evidence-based programs really reside. Our program about falls prevention, chronic disease self-management programs, diabetes self-management programs, really empowering individuals to have the power over their chronic disease, to be able to organize services, to be able to maintain their medication schedules, to have some more control over their own conditions. But it's also that intersection with the healthcare delivery system in this country, the medical care delivery system. And that's where we believe that our Aging Disability Resource Center and care transition programs come together to have that individual who is leaving an acute care facility have the services and the supports necessary for them to be able to return home and to be able to stay home and reduce those unnecessary rehospitalizations. We have often thought about these circles in the past as being silos, individual silos standing on their own. And I think many times when we begin to reorganize ourselves and look at the way that we're operating, too many times those things have changed from silos to cylinders of excellence. We just get better and better at doing these things. It's really the intersection of all of these programs coming together that are going to have the greater efficiency and effectiveness to maintain older adults and people with disabilities in their homes. So thank you very much.
Very good.
Thank you, Bob. Let's turn now to Cynthia Woodcock.
Hi, everybody. It's really nice to be here today. I'm going to talk a little bit about rebalancing long-term services and supports from the state's perspective. In my work at Hilltop at UMBC, I worked with a number of states, Maryland and others, and so have a pretty good sense of what states are thinking and feeling about this idea of rebalancing, which I'm going to define in just a minute. Let's see. So my first slide, as I said, I was going to define rebalancing for you. And it generally means moving away from a dependency on institutional care towards a system of comprehensive, community-based, long-term services and supports. And I'm going to use that acronym LTSS for long-term services and supports. So it's really, as you know, Mary Jane and Bob have been talking about, trying to promote more community-based services for people. And states are very, very committed to rebalancing. It's very much in their mantra of what everything they're doing. However, all of their efforts right now are driven very much by the need to reduce their budget deficits. It's very serious out there. And they have very big targets for budget deficit reduction. That's what it's all about with what's going on in the states now. And my second bullet, these are probably statistics many of you already know, but as of spring 2011, and this is the National Governors Association and the National Association of State Budget Officers reporting, 33 states projected $75.1 billion in budget gaps in FY 2012. And this wasn't even all of the states reporting yet. And they were all saying that Medicaid cost containment is a dominant theme in their FY 2012 budgets. So deficit reduction is big. Now, this chart is not intended for you to have to read all the little fine print at the bottom. I'm just going to tell you generally what it is. One of the measures that's used to determine how well states are doing in rebalancing, that is moving from institutional care towards more community-based care, is a measure that is the percentage of Medicaid LTSS spending, so their total spending for long-term services and supports, for home and community-based services. I didn't say that very well. Let me try that again. The percentage of spending for home and community-based services versus institutional care out of all of their long-term services and support spending. And overall, in 2009, states averaged spending about 33.8% of their LTSS funding on home and community-based services. So there's still a big amount of money being spent on institutional care. And there's been quite a bit of progress in recent years where that percentage for HCBS has been increasing. And in your packets, there is an excerpt from a paper that my colleague Chuck Milligan and I did and presented at an Academy Health meeting last June that gives a number of other charts on this same topic if you want to read a little bit more about it. But the point of this one is that there's tremendous variation across the states in how well they're doing in rebalancing. And on the far left, the tall bar, is New Mexico, which, according to the methodology used for this particular indicator, is doing very well on rebalancing, spending a very large proportion, like almost 70% of their funding on home and community-based services, versus way over on the right is Rhode Island with a very small percentage. But overall, the average is 33.8%. So this is, again, just one of the indicators that is being used. It's by no means all-inclusive. The ones Mary Jane is talking about in the scorecard give you a broader picture. In fact, this is one that's incorporated in the scorecard. Moving on. So what are states doing if they're really concerned about budget deficits, and but at the same time they really want to try to rebalance and continue the rebalancing activity? The big thing right now is manage long-term services and supports. This is a strategy many, many states are pursuing. We're hearing a lot about it. CMS is hearing from a lot of states. It's big. And so what is MLTSS? I'm giving you more acronyms, sorry. Manage long-term services and supports is a plan in which a contractor is accountable for providing beneficiaries with a defined set of LTSS in exchange for a prepaid capitation payment. So it's managed care for LTSS. And some plans include just Medicaid benefits. Others include Medicare and Medicaid benefits. And these are, there's a lot of different definitions floating out there, but that's generally kind of an integrated care plan that includes both Medicare and Medicaid. There's tremendous variation across the country in how states are implementing MLTSS. Right in 2009, enrollment was estimated at about 250,000 across the country, and 15 states have one or more MLTSS programs. 8 of these have multi-region or statewide programs. So some of them are operating with just small populations in states. Others are statewide and mandatory. 15 demonstration sites were funded in the spring of 2011 by CMS's Medicare and Medicaid Coordination Office. The Medicare and Medicaid Coordination Office is a new office set up under the Affordable Care Act, specifically focused on dual eligibles, those people who are enrolled in both Medicare and Medicaid. There is now a big demonstration underway. 15 states got up to $1 million apiece to begin to develop new kinds of integrated care programs. And they're planning to experiment with a variety of different models, so it's really something to watch. Also, a number of other states out there who don't have the demonstration grants are pursuing new forms of managed long-term services and supports. Every day it seems I hear of another state that's interested in it. For example, New Mexico, which by the way already has a statewide managed LTSS program for Medicaid clients, is now talking about implementing an 1115 waiver that encompasses all of Medicaid and would further promote MLTSS within that system. Similarly, New Jersey and Rhode Island are talking about 1115 waivers that encompass all of Medicaid, including LTSS. And I was at a conference 2 weeks ago on home and community-based services sponsored by NASHWAD, and there was a representative from CMS talking about how every day they're getting new applications from states, and more and more are wanting to go with managed long-term care or manage LTSS, thinking that this is the way they can help close some of their budget gaps. This slide is a map showing where there are existing MLTSS programs. The blue states have statewide or multi-region programs, and then the purple states have smaller kind of single-region programs. So just to give you a sense of the penetration across the country right now, but more is coming, believe me. Interestingly, the states with the more mature MTLSS programs tend to rank highest on the Commonwealth Fund and SCAN Foundation scorecard. Minnesota, which Mary Jane mentioned is at the top of the list, is one of the MLTSS states with a very mature program, and they've really been great innovators in Minnesota in the managed care area. What's kind of scary, if you will, about managed long-term services and supports is that while there are a number of states out there who have programs in place, they're all very different, and there have been very few evaluations done of these programs. So we really don't know a whole lot about what works well and what doesn't work so well. Also, there's very limited literature on best practices. The Center for Healthcare Strategies is one organization that's been out there trying to do a lot of research on best practices. They're actually a very interesting organization to follow if you don't already. And then perhaps the scariest thing to me is because all the states have these huge budget gaps to close, they're in a really big hurry to implement these new programs. And these programs are a really big deal to implement. I was personally working with New Mexico and implementing their program 2 years ago. And, I mean, it's huge, all the different things you have to consider. So it's a little bit scary when states talk about doing this so quickly. So to talk a little bit about some of the challenges in implementing one of these programs, first one is ensuring consumer choice, which Bob and Mary Jane both mentioned, and a person-centered care in a managed care environment. Many people are concerned once you have managed care, it takes the person out of the care. And so, you know, how can we work to preserve those features? Secondly, a very big one is how do you align incentives across payers? Many of the people that would be covered under these programs are dual eligibles. They are beneficiaries of both Medicare and Medicaid. How can you align the incentives across these two payers who many times are trying to, you know, push certain costs off on the other payer back and forth? It's a big deal. Secondly, how do you align incentives and how do you align across systems of care? For example, you have not only LTSS, but you have primary and acute care, and you have behavioral health, and the care transitions that Bob and Mary Jane were talking about. How can you align, you know, make sure all the incentives are set up right in a managed care environment to effectively manage across systems of care? Next, you know, how do you ensure effective service delivery? One of the big issues in LTSS is how can you figure out the right dose, if you will, of services for a particular person? How do you effectively assess that person and come up with what kind of services that person really needs to be stable in the community and to have a certain quality of life without oversubscribing or overprescribing, sorry, you know, in the interest of, you know, budget issues in states? You've got to figure out how do you best target services, the right amount to the right person. Next, how do you preserve and grow your provider networks? In any kind of managed care environment, you've got to have a concentration of providers for people to turn to in that managed care system. And in many states, you've got rural and frontier areas, Native American reservations, that don't have good provider coverage. And one of the challenges for managed care organizations or the health plans that are involved in these programs, you know, how can they develop their provider networks so they're sufficient to cover everyone? And my last bullet is about woodwork, and this is a term that I really don't like very much, but it's kind of out there. And it's really the unanticipated demand for service, for services. So many times if you offer a new service, there are people that you didn't count on coming forward wanting to access that service, which is a good thing if they need the service. But for states in who are having budget crises, it can be a problem when you can't adequately project how many people you're going to be serving when you offer a new service. And personal care services are a good example of this. One of the concerns many states have in providing personal care, many have moved to programs where friends and relatives are allowed to be the personal care attendants for Medicaid clients. And this is a good thing because it can provide employment for these friends and neighbors and relatives. It provides the client with a person who's caring for them that they know and they trust. However, many people believe that it's possible that by having programs such as this, you're actually substituting what was informal care, informal unpaid care, for paid care, and you're not serving more people but in situations like this. Oops. Okay, they're telling me to hurry. Next, I wanted to talk a little bit about a few of the features in the Affordable Care Act that are opportunities for states in the area of LTSS. I'm not going to explain each of these. I'm just going to go down the list quickly. But the Medicare and Medicaid Coordination Office, this is the office for dual eligibles. They're sponsoring demonstrations and hoping to align rules and regulations to make it easier for states to offer programs for duals. Community First Choice is a program for attendant care that states is an optional state plan benefit. The State Balancing Incentive Payments Program provides additional federal support to states who are meeting certain requirements for rebalancing. Medicaid Health Homes are promoting rebalancing. There's the Money Follows the Person program that provides incentives to states to move people out of institutions and place them in the community. The 1915i State Plan Amendment, and I'm going very fast because I'm out of time. The 1915i is a new state plan option where states can target certain populations of people for home and community-based services. And finally, the CLASS, the Community Living Assistance Services and Supports, which is a voluntary insurance program that can provide people who become disabled with some benefits for personal care and other long-term services and supports. And just a quick final note, my final slide. Many of the Affordable Care Act provisions are really terrific. States are pursuing them. However, sometimes there are requirements in them that are a deterrent to state participation. Just to give you a couple of ideas about this, Community First Choice, which is the optional state plan amendment for attendant care services. It's great. States can get an additional 6% federal participation on the dollars they spend on attendant care. The problem is there's a maintenance of effort requirement that says a state implementing Community First Choice this year must spend the same amount on personal care or attendant services as they spent last year, which is a good thing. However, many states have had personal care and attendant services expenditures going through the roof, and they're trying to implement cost containment strategies. So many states are going to have to try to come up with cost containment first and ratchet down their overall spending before they can look towards implementing Community First Choice. And I think I'm out of time, so I will conclude there.
And this is all good stuff, and we're going to have time to get to it in the Q&A section, I am sure. And now let's turn to Carol Raphael. Okay. Thank you very much, Cynthia.
Oh, good afternoon. I'm going to be talking from two perspectives. The first is as a provider of a system of long-term services and support, and really trying to convey to you what we're experiencing on the front lines. And then secondly, from the perspective of a state that is in fact trying to redesign its long-term services and support system. So very briefly, my organization, the Visiting Nurse Service of New York, this is its third century of existence. It serves the greater New York area. We have both a provider arm and a health plan arm. And in our provider arm, we see 31,000 patients on any given day. Now, when I said that we have a system, the way we try to think about it is that we deal with post-acute, long-term care, and people who are in palliative care and hospice at the end of life. And underlying all of it is behavioral and mental health support and services as well. Just very briefly to give you a profile of the kind of people we serve and enroll in our health plans, suffice it to say that they are a complex population. On average, they have 3 to 4 different diagnoses. It's very rare for us to have someone who just has diabetes. They often have congestive heart failure, pulmonary disease as well. On average, in our long-term care services, the people we serve have 5 to 6, I pledge to go into a jargon-free zone, so I'm trying to think of the way to describe ADL. So they have 5 to 6 areas where they have difficulty functioning, and on average, they take 10 medications, but we have people who take up to 21 different medications, and they tend to use a lot of services in the system. In our health, we have 2 health plans. We're licensed as an HMO in New York State. One is a long-term managed care plan where we're going to have 10,000 enrollees by the end of this year that provides a bundle of long-term care services for a Medicaid capitation payment. And we are a Medicare Advantage special needs plan for dual eligibles where we're going to have 7,000 enrolled by the end of this year. And there we provide all of the required Medicare services, A, B, and D. And I think two things to note. We have 1,600 people who are in both the long-term managed care plan and the special needs plan. And we really try very hard to do predictive modeling, to do in-home assessments and high-touch care management. And we're currently also trying a home visiting program for primary care. So what are the challenges? I'm going to talk about five challenges of being on the ground. And I'm going to start with our efforts to try to develop integrated care for a dual eligible population and for a population that needs acute and primary care as well as long-term care. And as I said, we have 1,600 enrollees that cross our plans, and we're trying to integrate our services to them. We're also applying for a community-based care transitions program that the federal government is trying to launch. We have just applied to become a health home in New York State, which is going to be targeted to a chronically ill behavioral health population, and the state would get a 90% federal match, so they have an incentive to try to think differently about how they organize care for this population. With one of our major players, Empire Blue Cross Blue Shield, we're trying a transitional care program where we really follow a group of patients into the community after a hospitalization, trying to prevent readmission. And we're working on something in our own health plan called SPARC. It's an advanced illness management program for people who have progressive illnesses. Secondly, our second challenge is trying to get sufficient capacity and having a competent and committed workforce. I was on the Institute of Medicine panel that took a look at retooling for an aging America and building the healthcare workforce of the future. I think we concluded that while seniors represent 12% of the population, they're very high users of a variety of services. We commented on the lack of specialists in geriatrics. Only 1% of nurses are in fact trained in geriatrics, and geriatricians, in addition to being insufficient in number, in fact are declining. Our recommendation was you cannot rely on specialists. You have to infuse the mainstream healthcare workforce with knowledge and competency in dealing with a geriatric population. But I just want to emphasize whatever little time I have on the direct care workers. You know, I read the Wall Street Journal's list of what are the fastest growing occupations in the United States, number 2 and 3. Home health aides, personal care workers, and we project a shortage that will be almost 1 million by 2016. The turnover rates are 40% to 60% in the first year, higher in the second year, and I think it kind of, while we recommended improvements in wages and benefits, particularly under Medicaid, we come up against what you'd refer to, Cynthia, which is what states are facing financially today. And their inability to really invest at this point. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the quality challenge, but it is a challenge. How to define, how to measure, and how to improve quality for a population receiving long-term services and support in a world where we define quality usually based on improvement. And this is a population that at best you're trying to maintain and prevent from declining. But we have a whole quality infrastructure that we work on, and we also are very much faced with public reporting and how we can succeed with Home Health Compare and the star ratings for Medicare Advantage plans. We also are working on efficiency as payments are reduced to us. We're relying extensively on technology. We've had an electronic health record system for over 10 years. I know Mary Jane knows this, but we shadowed Federal Express and trailed them everywhere because we have a mobile workforce, and they had the system that was most applicable to us. We could not do what we do without that kind of system. We're now working on exchanging information with physicians and hospitals in real time. I won't spend a lot of time on caregivers. I think that has been mentioned by several speakers. But I think our ability to integrate caregivers into the system is really going to be pivotal in the future. I'm now going to talk, if you can bear with me, and change to being a member of the New York State Medicaid redesign team. Medicaid spends about $53 billion in New York State, and we have a significant number of high-cost enrollees, 20% driving 75% of Medicaid expenditures. We have a large dual population. I was part of a Medicaid redesign team that Governor Andrew Cuomo put together to really take a look at how to redesign the Medicaid system and reduce costs. We were given a budget target of originally $2.8 billion that we had to save and contribute to closing the gap. There is a number of steps that we took, one I think you'd find particularly interesting, which is we did put a cap on growth. And that's being monitored, and hopefully so far we've been able to stay within the cap. But also, there were a number of work groups set up to take a look at elements of Medicaid. I am co-chairing the one on redesigning the long-term care system. And basically, as Cynthia already alluded to, our recommendation is to move toward a managed care system. And the state has applied to CMS to be permitted to target dual eligible beneficiaries and have a mandatory requirement that anyone who receives long-term care for more than 120 days and is over 21 but would be required to join a managed long-term services and support plan. We think there are many advantages in terms of trying to finally coordinate care in a very fragmented system, that there would be incentives to use home and community-based care and really rebalance more, that we would have a standardized assessment. I'm working on a subgroup that's looking at quality measurement and how we can really reward high performance. We think if we have the right risk adjuster, we can avoid some of the untoward effects of managed care, and it would allow for flexibility. However, it does raise issues that we are currently looking at very seriously, including building capacity and really preserving the home and community-based system we have. How can we ensure that providers can take on risk and manage risk? Cynthia made the point about developing networks, particularly in parts of upstate New York that are rural. How do we make sure there's adequate network? The issues around consumer education, protecting consumers, and fully engaging them. And lastly, we are one of the 15 states who got a grant to develop a fully integrated Medicare-Medicaid system. And so what we do now, we want to be sure paves the way for that future of an integrated approach. So thank you very much.
That's great. Thank you so much, Carol. Now you get a chance to join the conversation. I would also, let me just say explicitly, Mary Jane, you should be jumping in both to challenge our panelists and to offer your insights whenever it is appropriate. There are microphones in the back on either side. There are green cards on which you can write a question and hold it up. You don't even have to bring it up yourself. Someone will snatch it from your hand. Bob, if I can start with you while we're getting the audience engaged in both these ways. I wonder if you could, you talked a lot about the intersection in that last Venn diagram of long-term services and supports on the one hand and healthcare delivery system that is something that's been getting a lot of attention in this town. And I wonder, it looked awfully good on the diagram. How broad is your network? How much reach and how much potential beyond that reach is there in the aging network?
Well, thank you, Ed. Excellent question. In terms of the aging network, its reach, where are we? I think there is a lot of potential. As other speakers, Cynthia and Carol, had indicated, I think at a lot of the state and local level, the budget pressures are significant. But with funding becoming available through CMS, through their balancing incentives programs and others, I think there is even more potential to be able to reach vulnerable populations. When we say vulnerable populations, we also have to think about those individuals in rural areas and the ability through technology to have access to those individuals. One of the things that's become more apparent since I've been working more at the federal level, we've always talked about rural issues. There are also significant frontier issues in terms of being able to provide those supports, that there are some localities in this country that are still far away from provider networks, hospitals. So how do we really begin to look at the challenges of technology? In terms of care transitions, we are funding at this point 16 states to do care transitions work following evidence-based programs. Those are 16. The CMS projects that are rolling out, I think we're going to have a much broader base to that. But what we're trying to do is establish a foundation for the aging network to really have the expertise and the background to be able to perform those care transitions.
And before we go to the microphones, I wonder if I could ask somebody on the panel or everybody on the panel to clarify, or let me back up a step. How many people understand the relationship between Medicare and Medicaid in the context of dual eligibles, and why our panelists were talking about the need to realign incentives? What do you think? How many don't? Well, the co-chair will take the prerogative of assuming an undercount of those who don't, because the chair is not all that clear on it either. Could you just describe what the problem is when you put together a plan like your plan, Carol, and you're getting two streams of money, and maybe it's coming together, maybe it's not, in some other contexts or in yours?
I'll give one example. If you're successful in your long-term managed care plan, which you hopefully will be, in preventing unnecessary hospitalizations, you don't in Medicaid reap any of the benefits of that, preventing the cost of that particular hospitalization. So for us, a hospitalization generally costs $15,000. A readmission costs $9,000. But in our Medicaid plan, when we prevent that, we don't get those dollars to use and reinvest in some other part of the system.
I don't know
if you want to add to it.
Yeah, if you just, I can give some examples too. For example, if someone is in a nursing home and they're being paid for by Medicaid, if they get really sick, the incentive for the nursing home is to send them to the hospital to be cared for under Medicare if they're adult, because Medicare picks up the hospital care. That gets the nursing home out of having to pay for the more expensive care to stabilize them and keep them in the nursing home. And similarly, if someone is in the community under Medicaid, you want to be sure that they're getting the kind of care they need through Medicaid. If they have to be hospitalized, then they're going to be, again, going into a Medicare hospital stay. So there's this constant back and forth between Medicare and Medicaid with little coordination across the two payers. We've actually heard of situations with managed care organizations who are responsible for dual eligibles who say they don't always hear when one of their clients goes into a nursing home under a Medicare stay. They'd like to know because they would immediately start helping that client to transition out of the nursing home when they would come out and be on Medicaid in the community. So I don't know if that helps.
Okay. No, I think that's very helpful context. And you're all very patient. I believe we'll start on the one on the microphone on our right.
Thank you.
And I would ask that you identify yourself and keep the question as brief as you can.
Hi, I'm Brenda Sulik with the National PACE Association. And for those of you who don't know, PACE stands for the Programs for All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly. And we're a program that's been in existence for about 30 years. And we work with very frail seniors. 90% are dually eligible. We coordinate all their care. We integrate Medicare and Medicaid financing. We target a very sick population. My concern, and I guess I want to ask your opinion, is for people like the groups that PACE serve and other integrated programs who are really at the far end who need a lot of care coordination, a lot of intensive services, I'm concerned with states moving so quickly to some of the private managed care that they are going to be equipped to care for this population that needs a lot, who are very expensive, and I am worried about what's going to happen to these folks. Can any of you comment on that?
Well, I think that, in New York State, we have considered that issue. I'm someone who has said at the Medicaid redesign team that managed care for this population is very different because they need care from day one. It's not like they're going to be enrolled in maybe, day 200, they'll develop something and need to go to a physician. So this is a population that not only needs care from day one, they need care for a long period of time. And their relationship with whoever gives them care is so, so important to how they have quality of life. So I think that when you think about the requirements of the plan, you have to hold them responsible for care management and care coordination in a very rigorous way. And you have to have tests in terms of a track record and having had experience with this population.
Thank you.
That's a good start. Yes, Tony?
Hi, Tony Hausner, independent consultant, formerly with CMS. I'd like to ask the panel what their thoughts are, any recommendations to the deficit super committee on potential areas for savings long-term services and support systems, particularly what they can do legislatively to address these issues.
Presumably, you're not looking for none of the above.
That's right, yeah.
Anybody have any candidates? I should say, by the way, in the way of commercial, that we are planning a briefing on Medicaid specifically in the context of the super committee and the deficit reduction talks. I believe it's November 10th, so mark that one on your calendars.
Okay, thank you.
And we will review some alternatives there, I can assure you. Yes, Ann?
Yes, good afternoon. I'm Ann Montgomery with the Senate Aging Committee. I have two quick questions. One's a data question, and that is the ranking of states. I think in the Commonwealth analysis, Wisconsin, which Chairman Cole of the Aging Committee represents, was fifth, and then in the Hilltop analysis, more like 26th. So you could just, if you could just sort of explain how that is, that'd be helpful. And what kind of data, are available to make those rankings. Second, I wanted to ask about the mandatory enrollment, if I understand it, that New York will be proposing for duals. I guess that would involve a waiver of the freedom of provider choice that Medicare beneficiaries currently enjoy and always have enjoyed. So I'm wondering kind of how you propose to do that and why you think it's a good idea. Thank you.
I'll speak to the data question. In the Hilltop report, we were using Thomson Reuters data. It is that expenditure data that they collect from states, state Medicaid programs, showing the percentage of Medicaid LTSX expenditures on institutional versus community-based care. And that data is one component in the scorecard. The scorecard is a multifaceted group of measures looking at states from a variety of angles. And Mary Jane may want to add to that.
No, Cynthia's correct that it's a synthesis of many different indicators. We did use the Thomson Reuters data as part of it. We had a survey that AARP did of state agency directors out in the states. We also used a lot of CMS data. So what you're looking at in the scorecard are numbers of different ways of looking at some of the issues. So I think that the Hilltop report may look at one facet of it. The others sort of as a more combined look at it. Mm-hmm. If you do have questions, however, about methodology and kind of exactly how it was done, the team at AARP can really help you get behind the data, understand the methodology and the rankings.
In regard to the other issue, I think in general states have enrolled most of their Medicaid populations in managed care. And I know in New York State we've had fairly good outcomes, but that's been more the mainstream Medicaid population. And now we're beginning to try to think about how we can coordinate care for those populations who have traditionally been kept out of managed care and been in a fee-for-service system. And that includes the long-term services and support population, people with multiple chronic conditions, people with behavioral health issues. And I think that there's a view that however you design the system, that the enrollee has to have a choice of health plans, has to have a chance to understand the health plans, be educated about options, and that there has to be an enrollment process that really makes sure that consumers are both aware and protected. But my sense is that a number of states are moving toward managed care as a way to really try to bring about more coordinated care than we currently are seeing in the fee-for-service system for these populations.
Can I just ask, what kind of consumer protections, beneficiary protections are there in the more general managed care for Medicaid programs that, as you say, are now far more common than the alternatives?
Well, I think one of the major protections is the ability to disenroll and to leave the plan and vote, you know, with your feet and to go to another plan.
Well, and also many states have a number of plans that an enrollee can choose from. And can I say one?
Please.
On the managed LTSS, one of the big challenges in integrating Medicare and Medicaid is that on the Medicaid side, states, through waivers, can require that people participate in the managed care plan, giving them usually choice among several different health plans. On the Medicare side, the freedom of choice provision in Medicare prohibits states from doing the same thing on the Medicare side, saying we need you to enroll in a certain health plan. So so states have had a difficult time figuring out how to enroll a dual eligible with the same health plan for both their Medicare and Medicaid benefits. If they were enrolled with the same health plan, then that health plan could work across the two benefit packages to streamline the provision of services and work against the incentives that are the disincentives. And in many states, what they're trying to do, and I think you mentioned this in New York, they're using Medicare Advantage special needs plans as the health plan on the Medicare side, and then hopefully encouraging people on the Medicaid side to enroll, say, with United Healthcare in their SNP and their Medicaid plan. It's not always working because there's not penetration of Medicare Advantage SNPs throughout the states in most cases. So it's a less than perfect model, and states are striving for what kind of model is there to integrate the two services.
And in the 15 demonstration states you were talking about, is that what's going on?
Yes, and you're one of them. So, yes, some of the states are talking about a SNP kind of model. Some of the states, as I understand it, are talking about actually being the recipient of all the Medicare and Medicaid monies flowing into the state and then dispersing them to health plans to manage both the Medicare and Medicaid benefits for individuals. So CMS is working with states to experiment with a variety of options. And Carol, you may have something
to add. I think for us it's sort of still too early stage, right?
Yeah.
Paige Cunningham with the Washington Times, and my question is primarily, Bob, it was about the CLASS Act, and I was hoping for your thoughts on some of the recent reports raising questions about its sustainability long-term. Are there any specific components of the act that concern you or any changes you think should be made to it?
Let me be very candid. At this stage, I'm not going to talk a lot about the CLASS Act. I know there's been a number of things in the press recently. The office is still open and operating. Kathy Greenlee is our Assistant Secretary for Aging. That CLASS office is still there. And I believe a report will be coming out shortly about the activities that have been going on and some of the program areas of the CLASS office. But outside of that, we'll wait for that report to come out.
There's a related question on one of these cards, and I don't know, Mary Jane may have it, but it had to do with the ability, either in the prospect with CLASS Act enrollees or in the current context with private long-term care insurance, about the prospects of integrating public and private dollars to deal with this range of service delivery questions. Is that something that you know about in existence or being contemplated anywhere?
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is the system today does rely on both public and private dollars. I mean, while Medicaid is the largest public payer for long-term services and supports, out-of-pocket expenditures are quite significant. I think last I looked, it was about 23 to 25% of the costs are, in fact, paid out-of-pocket. So right now, in fact, we do have a meshing of the gears of a public and private system, although some of the latest information describes how hard it is for people, particularly in middle income ranges, to afford the cost of long-term services and support.
Actually, we got a question in advance that I should throw into this discussion, because this person is asking, in the context of the challenges to the CLASS Act, what's the alternative? What's going to happen if there is no insurance model developed for taking care of some of the currently out-of-pocket expenses that are obviously very substantial for a lot of the population? And maybe that question reverts back to what I was asking about private insurance. Is there any sense that there is a future in private long-term care insurance, I guess, or a future for beneficiaries in long-term care insurance?
I think there's still very much a role for private long-term care insurance, and how can we encourage people to and help people to purchase it. Even with CLASS, it's my understanding it's not going to cover the whole bill, and I think it's likely to give people a sense of false security if we aren't careful, and I think there's got to be this blend of public and private.
And I think the issue with private long-term care insurance is the penetration has been limited over many years. It certainly also purchase has been affected by our economic circumstances. So in order to make that viable, we have to increase the risk pool. You have to really get more people to participate. And then you get into the issue of affordability, because most people are in their 50s when they begin to think about it, and then by the time they purchase, it's not necessarily affordable. So you come up against the issue of how do you get younger people at an earlier stage to somehow participate in an insurance plan, and we have not yet been successful in coming up with viable alternatives. There are always proposals about some kind of tax benefit as an incentive, and it's hard to know whether or not that would be the key to unlock this door.
Fair enough. Good, thank you. I believe you were next.
Sue Ellen Galbraith with Anchor, and I'm delighted to hear so much conversation about class. And currently the real alternative is Medicaid, which is a most unfortunate alternative that people have to become poor, spend down, and add to the Medicaid roll. So we're delighted, Bob, to hear that class and the implementation is moving forward on that. It's a very important program. My question or comment had to do with some of the data and perhaps with Ann's question, because I think some of the reporting on the data on the difference between institutional and balancing and expenditures is because the reliance is on aging and physical disabilities and not necessarily the whole service delivery system that includes intellectual and developmental disabilities, of which I haven't heard a great deal of discussion here. And so, Carol, in New York, my understanding is that the redesign is group is looking at a separate 1115 waiver for the intellectual and developmental disabilities population. Is that the case? And if so, why separate that out in terms of long-term services?
I'm not really sure. I know that it's not part of our purview. I mean, just really dealing with the current long-term services and support system is quite a Herculean endeavor, but I don't know yet what the approach will be on the developmentally disabled sort of part of the spectrum.
Also, to respond to that in terms of the scorecard, one of the first steps that we took when we developed the long-term supports and services scorecard was to kind of, as I said, wrestle with the definition of what was incorporated under that long-term services and supports. And we thought long and hard about should we be including services for the developmentally disabled, for the mentally retarded, for a lot of the serious and persistently mentally ill. And just in the, I guess, in the hope to bring clarity to at least a part of the discussion, we kind of did limit the discussion to that, but we clearly recognized how important those other components are and how they very much really and truly are long-term supports and services. So it's a good question.
If I could add too, and certainly appreciate any input, you know, we've begun expanding our portfolio in terms of working with persons with disability in the community. We've also begun recently working very closely with NIDR, the National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research. They certainly fund a number of their regional centers. But looking at the issue of aging with disability, I think the Administration on Aging and others have a good handle on what happens to people in their older years. And NIDR and others have a good handle on what happens to younger individuals. But there is a whole cohort who are aging with that disability, and there's less information about what does that mean for populations who 30, 40 years ago would not have survived into old age, maybe particularly individuals with intellectual disabilities. We also know that individuals with Down syndrome have a much greater prevalence of Alzheimer's as they age. Well, in our work with NIDR, as well as with the National Institute on Aging, really beginning to focus on that cohort because those individuals will be coming to an aging system who perhaps have never been able to access that system before. So as we understand more about that, I think input from many different groups will be very important because we're going to be looking at a population that we just haven't served before.
Thank you. Cheryl Phillips, Leading Age, and my background is I'm a geriatrician, and I come from California, so I understand the whole managed care thing. And the Medicaid pieces for long-term supports and services have in some places been done very well, but I'm concerned about, as you talked about this speed, one of the things that I haven't heard, and I do appreciate that managed care as an integrated payer mechanism doesn't necessarily define integrated service delivery. And sometimes the only vehicle for saving money is, in fact, finding the lowest vendor purchase price in order to put together a network of services. Within the long-term supports and services under these managed care Medicaid models, what is the standard or expectation for how those providers work together or communicate or integrate? Right now, the beneficiaries, although it's a very fragmented world, and I'm hardly defending the present world, very often those individuals and or their families make a patchwork of communication and integration. But under mandatory enrollment, that may all fall apart. And so if we're just purchasing long-term supports and services on a purchase price, but don't have standards about how they work together to a common care plan, a common care coordination, I think we have problems with transitions now. We may see them at biblical proportions if that isn't thought of carefully.
I agree. I think it's something that is not, that needs a lot more careful attention.
I would just, you know, sort of second that. I don't think that in managed care right now, that in managed care systems for the chronically ill, we have really devoted enough attention to really figuring out how you integrate service across sectors. And there's no magic bullet that is going to make that happen. It has to do with really thinking differently about patient care, thinking differently about who's accountable for what, thinking differently about how we communicate and practice. And that is something that I think managed care has the potential to change. But right now, I don't think it's at the forefront of how, you know, most managed care plans are really thinking.
To respond also to Cheryl's concern, you know, it'd be interesting to look at some managed care plans that are doing a really fantastic job and start to see kind of what did they do in order to do that and to sort of build those criteria into states that are approving plans so that we actually start to have some kind of, if you will, measure of the ability of the plans who often come at this as insurers who are suddenly going to be thinking about service delivery to really sort of key them in on what the important issues are. I mean, I think the thing that's interesting about some of what Carol's talking about is you have a provider who became an insurance plan. And so they knew the population and they knew the demand for services and how those services had to be integrated to work, and then sort of took the step to become the payer. And so what we're seeing now, especially in, as Cheryl referred to, this rush to sort of put managed long-term care into the system, is we're having insurance plans who don't understand these populations, which is a real danger.
And I think, I think that's very true. And we were involved in some focus groups in several states recently with managed LTSS programs. And typically the beneficiaries themselves didn't, in what supposedly were integrated care programs, they still talked about their Medicaid benefits and their Medicare benefits. And they had separate cards for each one, sometimes three or four cards for different programs. And there were a few cases where there were programs that seemed to be truly integrated from the beneficiary's point of view, where they said, yes, I have one card and I have one service coordinator, and that person helps me manage all my benefits across whatever it is. So I think we have a long way to go.
And, you know, I would just add, while I think plans will require that there be care coordination, I think the question is, how do you really activate it and make it happen every day? And, you know, and we do talk a lot about patient-centered care, but how do you make that happen? And I think that's going to involve a lot of efforts from a lot of different directions.
And Mary Jane noted in her presentation that you didn't even have enough data on this set of issues to begin to rank people.
One of the things that's very heartening, I think, is that the Office for Coordinated Medicare Medicare and Medicaid is that they are requiring that states, as they think about these things, that they involve consumer stakeholders and really ensure that it's the beneficiaries who are at the table informing policymakers about what works, what doesn't work, what the concerns are, and that some of the unintended consequences that really can come when you do things in a hurry, so that there are safeguards for the beneficiaries are built into the system. And I think it's really very good that CMS has really sort of taken that position, that you have to listen to the actual recipients and hear from them how it's going to work and how it works for them.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Carol Regan. I'm with the Paraprofessional Healthcare Institute, PHI. And I wanted to pick up on a couple of an issue of care coordination. And a number of you mentioned how important the direct care workforce is in providing services, in particular paid care services, not in addition to family caregivers. And yet, in looking at a lot of these care coordination models, I'm struck with the fact that very few involve the direct care worker, who are really the eyes and ears of the person who's getting the services, who's in the home all the time. And if we're really going to be successful in care coordination, it seems to me part of that team ought to be the paraprofessional. I'm wondering if some of you could comment on that. It just seems as we're moving more towards managing care and preventing rehospitalization, involving the direct care worker as part of the team is really part of the solution. So I'd love to hear some of your comments on that. Thank you.
Well, I think that I know at the Visiting Nurse Service of New York, we're really working on creating a team where the direct care worker is just a key member of that team. And, in fact, we have found that when we have done surveys, there's higher satisfaction rates and much lower turnover when the direct care worker really feels that they matter and they are the eyes and ears of the team, and they have a place to call when they detect a problem, and we can move in early. So I can't conceive of a care coordination system for long-term services and support that does not have the direct care worker as part of the team.
Good. Mary Jane, maybe you can take advantage of some of the questions that people have sent on cards. And let me just say, while we're doing that, we're down to our last few minutes, that I would appreciate your hauling out those blue evaluation forms and filling them out as we finish up here. Yes, go ahead.
There was one question, and again, we've been throwing around quite an alphabet soup of terminology here, that somebody asked about ADRCs, which are Aging and Disability Resource Centers. And Bob, you want to just sort of say whether or not you think they're working or how they're working?
We have been in partnership with our colleagues at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services since about 2005 in funding these Aging and Disability Resource Centers. At the last information I had, there are 365 ADRCs across the country. 19 states are statewide in their coverage of Aging and Disability Resource Centers. In terms of their working, what we have found over the years, as I mentioned before in a presentation, is that access to these long-term services and supports have been incredibly fragmented. Multiple applications, multiple sites to visit, multiple offices to access. What the fully functioning ADRCs have been able to do is, if not co-locate physically, co-locate in a virtual environment with the Medicaid agency, with other agencies, to really provide a no-wrong door across many different spectrums of older adults and disability populations, to be able to have the information available to the older adult, person with disability, and their caregivers, to really have the information by which they can make their best decisions. I think as we look at expanding beyond older adults, 77 of those ADRCs are actually operated or co-operated by Centers for Independent Living, which also gives the whole network a greater understanding of the issues that persons with disabilities really face. So I think they are a vital part of our aging network. They provide a great function in terms of providing the information that older adults and persons with disabilities receive. One of the aspects that we're also embarking on, if I could just go down a slightly different road, since we talk a lot about person-centeredness, in collaboration with just about every other operating division in HHS and beyond HHS, we're working with the Department of Labor and others, in terms of developing core competencies for options counselors in terms of participant direction. Those core competencies, what we really want to do are trainings with these options counselors across the ADRC spectrum, but also in area agencies and other agencies to really begin to understand what it means to have a participant directed focus in terms of all of our long-term services and supports. It is beginning with those options counselors, but the end game is really to look at the system and the organizational level so that that front office options counselor really has the support and the information behind them of the whole network, the whole organization at the local level, to be able to offer these services in a real person-centric way. And we're hopeful of beginning that operation very shortly.
Okay. And one other question that's actually kind of interesting that touches on the issue of housing. I mean, we talk a lot about home and community-based services, but if you don't have a home, it makes it problematic. And, you know, with the economy the way it is and housing the way it is, that can be a real issue. And there's a question about states' ability under their Medicaid waivers to do sort of one-time transitional housing costs, such as security deposits, and if there were any comments on that.
Well, I don't know that I can comment on behalf of CMS, but we do know that even in our care transition programs that we've been involved with, certainly leaving a nursing facility, the idea of being able to have a home to return to has been a significant barrier in far too many cases. To be able to turn the lights on, have energy in the system, to be able to pay that first month's rent, security deposit. But I think some of the work that CMS has been doing is really taking a long step in a positive direction. But housing continues to be an issue. We're working closely with HUD. We have a number of joint projects going on with HUD, as well as Henry Claypool from the Office of Disability under the Community Living Initiative, has really been leading a lot of the charge in terms of looking at the housing issues, particularly for individuals with disabilities, but being able to access 202 housing, housing vouchers. So we know it's a continuing issue, but I think there's some headway beginning to be made.
I can add one thing to that.
Yes, Cynthia?
On the housing issue, I think it's 43 states now have Money Follows the Person programs, which are programs to incentivize states to move people from institutions to the community. And there are Money Follows the Person transition services that states can get financial support for transitioning people. It sometimes includes security deposits, modifications, that sort of thing, so that they can move into housing that is accessible. And also, as part of their Money Follows the Person programs, a number of states have active housing groups and initiatives where they're really trying to develop housing at the local level, working with many of the federal agencies, as Bob is talking about. So I think Money Follows the Person is being a pretty strong force in the housing development movement.
Well, that's an appropriate last word, I believe. As we draw to the close of this program, I want to thank all you folks for your active participation. I know some of these issues are enough to make you shiver. At least I think it's the issues that are making you shiver. And if you'll do one more task, and if you haven't filled out that evaluation form, do it in these last seconds. I want to thank our colleagues at the Commonwealth Fund for helping shape this program in a very good way, having actively participated in it and co-sponsored it as well, and ask you to join me in thanking our panel for taking on a lot of these tough issues in a very thoughtful way.